Where are you, Mr. McGann?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Terrence McGann, appearing on behalf of the Appellant, Chicago Regional Council of Carpenters. This appeal is taken from a decision of the District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. The appeal relies upon the stipulated facts and documents which were identified in our pretrial submissions.
Your Honors, I found it hard to follow your argument. Maybe you could make it a little simpler or clearer. So you're relying on an arbitration clause in a 1999 collective bargaining agreement, but your concern seems to be about a 2004 agreement. So am I missing some? I don't understand how the 1999 arbitration clause requires arbitration of something in a 2004 collective bargaining agreement.
Your Honor, the case actually arose under the 2004 contract, which is a successor agreement. After the union failed to receive notice of termination under the 1999 agreement, the union had assumed that the rollover provision of the Evergreen Clause would have bound...
But could I stop you there? Because you do not spell out in any specificity why you think this particular 1999 CBA has an Evergreen Clause. And even if it does, I don't see how the continuation of the 1999 agreement, which did not cover Racine County, suddenly sweeps in Racine County. Usually Evergreen means that the 99 agreement is now replicated for the next period of time, but that doesn't get you as much as you need. There's still no agreement to arbitrate with respect to this new territory.
I certainly don't disagree with that, Judge.
Well, then that's your case.
Well,
I mean, if there's no agreement to arbitrate for these particular places.
With all due respect, it doesn't necessarily determine the case. Because what's that Evergreen Clause doing?
Well, what Evergreen Clause, first of all? Is it this ambiguous language in 25.2 you're talking about?
We're talking about the 25.2, and at least our interpretation, we never got to this, but our interpretation of that particular provision requires Stevens to come to the table and say, let's negotiate. That never happened. But even more importantly, Judge.
But then the only thing is, if they don't come, they've conceded the changes in wage rates and conditions of employment for the new contract. They haven't conceded geographic coverage of the new contract.
Arguably, we never got to that issue, Judge, but I'm asking you, why didn't you argue it at least before us? That AT&T Technologies basically says that it is for the Board of Arbitrations to determine, number one, if that contract was properly terminated, and what that remedy will be.
But it's also for the court, under first options against Kaplan, it's for the court to decide, is there an agreement to arbitrate, period. And that's, I think, the first question that Judge Coran was looking at. Is there an agreement to arbitrate the dispute that you have put before the employer? And so in the course of deciding that, he had to decide whether there was any agreement between Stevens and the union in 2004. He had to decide what does this Evergreen Clause, if there is one, I mean, again, this ambiguous language. So that's all the judge is doing.
Your Honor, that is precisely the issue in the case.
Right, and he decides the issue, and under first options, it's for the court unless there's very clear language.
Absolutely.
Giving that to the arbitrator, and there's nothing approaching clear language
The problem with the court's analysis is rather than analyze the 1999 contract that had the termination provision in it, what it did was it truly answered the underlying claim, which, as Your Honor knows, under the trilogy of Steelworkers Trilogy, number two, is what courts should not do. And that's precisely where we take issue. If you take a look at the transcript from the trial proceedings and the judge's rationale, the cart got put before the horse.
How is he supposed to decide if there's an agreement to arbitrate without deciding whether the 1999 agreement's Evergreen Clause carries forward?
Your Honor, he doesn't.
He has to make a decision, is there an agreement? And since the only arbitration language available to you is in the old 1999 agreement, it's inevitable.
But, Your Honor, the parties concede, and the court found, that they were bound by the 1999-2004 contract. It was upon that contract, rather than a 2004 contract, that the court should have analyzed these facts. For example, under the Steelworkers Trilogy, the court's burden number one...
But what interpretation of this Section 25.1 would give you the relief you're seeking?
Your Honor, our understanding, and I think it's 25.2, that in the event that there's not sufficient notice, that the parties would then attempt to meet. In the event that they could not reach a agreement on a successor, the association agreement, which Stevens was previously bound and was affiliated with, would apply. That was the union's interpretation, and I believe, although I will submit it's not part of the record, that that was the industry understanding.
What about the testimony, at least in your opponent's brief, it says the notices the carpenters and the association exchanged complied with the 1999 CBA and had the effect of terminating the 1999 CBA on May 31, 2004, including as to Stevens.
I would submit to you that the notice that was sent by the union, not Stevens, was a notice to meet and discuss the terms of the successor agreement. I would also submit to you, Your Honor, under our...
Accordingly, I don't have the transcript in front of me, but that was the testimony from apparently an adverse witness called by Stevens.
Jeffrey Jagies was the witness that was called. In fact, it was the only witness in the case.
Right.
I would submit to you that under our theory of this case, our theory of attempting this, that's an issue, that's testimony that is more properly brought before the Board of Arbitrators under the 1999 agreement. That is why we didn't present any evidence, Your Honor, because in our theory of this case, all of the evidence that was brought by Stevens Construction is more properly put in the forum in which the parties agreed to, and that's the Board of Arbitrators under the 1999 contract. And the issue of what is the ultimate award or resolution, is there a rollover clause? I don't know. I can't answer it. What I can say is under the theory that we have in this case, it wasn't for the district court to make that determination.
Well, in your view, then, this is really a contract where the arbitrator determines whether there's an agreement to arbitrate. And the problem with that I have with that is that it fails, in my view, to meet the first options standard of clarity.
That's truly not my argument, because I believe even under the AT&T Technologies case, I believe it's clear that it is for the court to determine arbitrability. And I believe that the court had that duty.
And part of that is determining whether there is extant an agreement out there between the two parties. And since you concede, it certainly isn't on its face the 2004 CBA. One has to get fancier than that, even under your view. You know, you've got to find some way that Stevens is under that 2004 CBA, which is what takes you back to the 99 CBA. But this strikes me as all interpretation of language of the agreement about whether there's somewhere out there an agreement to arbitrate between these parties.
Your Honor, I don't think that in order to make a determination in this case, we have to look at the 2004 agreement at all. I don't think we do. Because I think what the Steelworkers Trilogy tells us...
Why don't you need it at least for geographic scope?
Because
the nature of the agreement.
Because by looking at the geographic scope or looking at the nature of the work, for example, if that's a defense to this, any of those defenses, again, should be brought before the Board of Arbitration. And the view in this case, Your Honor, is not whether or not the work was performed in Racine versus Kenosha. The question that was...
But you agree there was never actually something on paper that said the carpenters and Stevens agree to arbitrate disputes with respect to Racine County work?
Never.
Never. Okay.
Never. But the point is that the issue that was brought, the issue that we were seeking to compel before the Board of Arbitration, was this issue of whether or not Stevens complied with the contract with respect to termination. under the 1999-2004 agreement. That's the decision the court has to make before we get to whether or not there's an evergreen clause.
Are you saying you served this written notice to which 25.2 applies, to which it refers? You filed that notice, and then Stevens didn't show up? Is that your argument?
I'm saying what the facts will show, Judge, what was elicited at the trial was that Stevens, during the period of 1999-2004, disaffiliated with the Employer Association. The union never knew about it. February 28, 2004, the deadline to submit termination came and passed before the union was ever aware that Stevens Construction wasn't part of the historical Employer Association. Didn't know it. The first time that we learned as an organization that Stevens was no longer part of this organization was after that February 28th, 2004 deadline.
That's contrary to the testimony, again, that's set forth. On February 10th, 2004, the association provided notice to the carpenters that the 1999 CBA was to terminate when it expired on May 31st, 2004.
That's correct. However, at the point in time that notice was sent, Your Honor, Stevens Construction was no longer being represented by the association.
Right.
They had disaffiliated before then.
But the distinction is, the union knew perfectly well that the old contract was going to expire. Then, a different topic, what's the new contract going to look like, is discussed in the later letter, the early March letter, where the Employers Association says, now these are the people that we're representing going forward. And
yes.
I don't see that there's that much ambiguity there. Stevens was still bound, arguably, all the way up until May 31st, even though maybe they were trying to get out sooner. And if there had been a question of pension contributions during the year 2004 up until May, or all sorts of things, then Stevens would be bound. But going forward, under the new time period, I don't see why this isn't just a different topic.
Your Honor, I believe it is a different topic.
And I
would suggest to you that this case is far simpler than analyzing two separate contracts, worrying about the relationship between two separate contracts. The only issue that the union seeks to have a decision on is whether or not Stevens Construction validly terminated the 1999 contract.
Okay, suppose it didn't, then what?
That I believe, Your Honor, under the AT&T Technologies case, it is for the Board of Arbitrators to determine what the ramifications of that failure is. It may be, in this industry, it may be their interpretation that it constitutes a rollover. It may not be. There ultimately may be no recovery. I don't know. But the point is the integrity of the arbitration system, which has been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court, Congress, through the FAA, is in jeopardy here. And that's our point for bringing this case, Your Honor. Ultimately,
okay.
They may not be a resolve.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McGann. Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Levine?
Appreciate your time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. John Levine, Amy Hartwig, and Christy Foy on behalf of Stevens Construction.
Mr. Levine, let me ask you whether the record contains any information about Stevens' relationship to this multi-employer association, and in particular, whether in this industry it is customary for members of such an association separately to give notice to the union during the course of an agreement. I mean, clearly people come and go from these multiple employer associations. You can see that even by the March 4 letter. But it looked to me like there was a lot of paperwork involved. And I wonder when Stevens failed to tell, you know, gee, it would have been one more stamp, you know, failed to tell the union that you were withdrawing, whether you were deviating somehow from the normal course of behavior.
Well, Your Honor, there is no evidence in the record on that issue. The union specifically declined to put evidence in on that issue.
No, but I'm talking about the contractor association. If the contractor association says, at the same time you tell us you're bailing out, you got to tell any unions that we have CBAs with, then that would be from your side.
There's no evidence in the record on that, Your Honor. The practice that I'm familiar with, and I've been handling cases with the associations for some time, is that those who gave bargaining authority to the association for the prior contract are covered by the notice of termination that the association gives preparing for the successor agreement. And that's exactly what happened in this case. If you look at the notice that the association gave, it specifically covered those contractors who had given bargaining authority for the 99 contract, which, as the union's president acknowledged during the hearing, was understood to be on behalf of Stevens.
Was that the witness, the only witness who was called?
Yes, the union president? Yes, the only witness we called, Your Honor, was the union president.
And he's the one that made these admissions that appears on page 9 of your brief?
That's correct, Your Honor. The union argued.
So your position really depends critically on a sharp distinction between the notice of termination of the 99 CBA, on the one hand, and the negotiation process and eventual conclusion of the successor agreement, the 2004 agreement, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I followed your question. Our position simply is that arbitrability is for the court to decide, and court did decide arbitrability.
Yeah, but the thing is, the court may have decided arbitrability wrongly if the 1999 agreement as a matter of law continued with respect to Stevens when the union didn't find out until after the expiration date that Stevens wasn't going forward with the new agreement. The only thing...
That's not true.
Well, I'm just saying, I know that you don't think that's true, but I'm just saying their argument is that when the union didn't find out until after the expiration date for giving the notice, that Stevens and a bunch of other companies, actually, there's a whole paragraph of company names, were not going forward, then the 99 agreement necessarily, then Stevens was necessarily included, I think they're arguing, in virtually everything that went on, or at least the arbitrator would have to decide that Stevens didn't effectively bail out of this association.
That's not the case, if I may, Your Honor.
The case that it's their argument, or it's not the case on the substance?
It's not the case on the substance.
All right. It is their argument.
If you look at Article 25 of the 1999 agreement, 25.1 and 25.2, whether or not, I understand that the argument of the union is and always has been that Stevens is bound by virtue of a failure to give proper notice under the 99 agreement, but if you look at 25.2, whether or not the union's theory would be correct would have nothing to do with whether or not Stevens gave proper notice. The issue under 25.2 is, did someone give proper notice, and then did the other someone refuse to meet for purposes of negotiating an agreement? In this particular case, Your Honor, Stevens never was requested to meet with the union. The union sent Stevens a contract saying, sign this. And Stevens said no, and that was the end of it. The union went away for 5.5 months, or almost 5 months, and then filed this grievance under the 2004-2008 CBA.
Right, but I mean, I don't place a huge amount of weight in that, because it seems to me, you know, a lot of people adopt belt and suspenders sorts of strategies. You have to be relying on the fact that in 25.1, the reference to the term by the party desiring to terminate or modify means only the multi-employer association, and the party desiring to terminate can't possibly mean the individual company.
That is our interpretation, Your Honor, yes.
And that it's an interpretation. This is a terrible contract. It's very vague.
I didn't negotiate
quite
this
a few things. Too bad.
If I may, just a couple of points, Your Honors. The union argues here and in brief that the district court's error, and this is the only error, alleged error, that it appeals in this case, was deciding as part of its arbitrability analysis that the 1999 CBA was properly terminated. There are many problems with this argument, but let me highlight a couple of them. Number one is, the union got, in this case, exactly what it asked for. The union, in one of its counterclaims, specifically asked the district court to declare that Stevens failed to terminate the 1999 CBA in accordance with 25.1, and for that reason became bound by the 2004-2008 agreement.
So you're essentially saying they waived the right to have the 99 contract arbitrated? Because there certainly are interpretation questions about
it. It would appear that they did waive it, Your Honor.
What does 25.1 mean? I don't understand it. It says, agreement shall continue in full force in effect until May 31st, provided. Now, about the written notice, if the proviso is not satisfied, what does that mean? That the agreement terminates sooner, on May 31st, later, or what?
Your Honor, I'm not sure exactly what it means. Reading 25.1 in its entirety.
Only the arbitrators could determine what it means.
If you read 25.1 in its entirety, Your Honor, the purpose of 25.1 is to create an arrangement where the association can give notice or the union can give notice without also filing a simultaneous notice with federal authorities. If you look further in 25.1...
But what's the purpose of the notice? I don't understand. Why doesn't it just end, the agreement shall be binding upon the parties and shall continue in full force and effect until May 31st, 2004? Why doesn't it stop there, that the contract goes to May 31st, 2004? What's the rest of 25.1 about?
The rest of 25.1 is about whether or not a notice under Section 8D of the National Labor Relations Act is also required to be filed by the parties with the Federal Mediation Conciliation Service and the WERC.
Why? Can't you just have a contract expire?
Sure you can.
On May 31st?
You sure could.
Then why do you have this other stuff?
I didn't negotiate the contract, Your Honor.
What? Didn't the union concede that it terminated on May 31st?
Yes.
2004?
The union conceded that point. The union also conceded, Your Honor, that, and this is at page 2 of its brief, that the grievance that it filed demanded arbitration under the 2004-2008 CBA, not the 1999 CBA.
But, you know, you think that's a huge concession, but, I mean, it really all folds back into the question whether Stevens, by operation of failing to let the union know by the February 28th date, was still within the multi-employer association, because the CBAs both say that they're between the ACS and the union, not, you know, company A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. So, yes, they would have said that, but I think that's quite consistent with their theory.
I think whether or not Stevens was or was not a member of the association is immaterial to the contract interpretation issue that you've described. The issue is...
Why is it immaterial? If the union is right, then Stevens is still de facto, or actually de jure, bound by what the ACEA negotiated.
Under the National Labor Relations Act, a party cannot be bound to multi-employer negotiations or bargaining units if it is properly withdrawn from the association. That means whether notice was given or not would be immaterial. They can't be bound once a proper withdrawal has occurred.
They can be bound if they agreed to.
If they agreed to it, they could be.
You say you didn't draft 25.1.
No, Your Honor.
But you represent the association.
No, not in this case. We represent many contractors with the association. We do some work for the association when they ask for advice of different kinds, but we did not negotiate.
So you don't know what 25.1 means?
25.1, Your Honor, no.
Well, maybe it means that if Stephen sneaks away, it has to comply with the new agreement.
If I may close.
What can it mean that?
Pardon me?
Why can't it mean that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. You have to repeat.
Why can't it mean that if Stephen sneaks away, quits the Contractors Association, and doesn't tell the union, that it becomes bound to the next contract?
Well, that's not what it says.
It's We don't know what it says, for goodness sake. You don't know what it means,
It specifies.
You don't know what it means.
It specifies that a notice should be given.
You said you don't know what 25.1 means.
Well, I know that 25.1...
How can you exclude this meaning?
I know that 25.1 specifically says that a notice should be given by a certain time, and a notice was given.
What purpose is the notice given?
The purpose that a notice is given is to alert the other side that bargaining is to commence for a successor agreement.
But they know that, because it expires May 31st, 2004, so naturally they know there's going to be a successor agreement. It has to be negotiated before.
But it's to get prepared for the negotiations. That's why there's a 60 or a 30-day notice, as the case may be. That's why the federal law has the simultaneous 8D notice as well.
Okay. Can I close?
Thank you, Mr. Levine. No, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Your time has expired, Mr. McCann. So, move on to our next case, United States.